What Mexico has not done over the last two decades is seriously tackle the issues of the institutions in the labor market, of taxation, and of corruption and its judicial institutions. This has been extremely costly to Mexico.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Looking back on Mexico's recent history, there's a paradox. Since the 1990s, economically, Mexico has done most things right. Successive governments brought down inflation and stabilized the economy. It opened to trade, exports flourished, investment shot up. Education has improved and poverty has declined, but Mexico's economic growth has been disappointing. Or, as Santiago Levy puts it in the foreword to his latest book, why has a country that has done so many things right failed to grow fast? That book's called Under-Rewarded Efforts, The Elusive Quest for Prosperity in Mexico. And it's available, you can download it, from the Inter-American Development Bank website, where Santiago worked for many years. He's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was also one of the architects of the influential Progresa Poverty Relief Program. Today I'm talking to Santiago about what he discovered in his research for this book and the reasons for Mexico's disappointing development. Also, what might be done about it. Santiago, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you for the opportunity.
When you consider the scale of reform that was accomplished in Mexico's economy since the tequila crisis of the mid-90s, you really get the impression from the first few pages of your book that there is a lot to praise in Mexico's recent history.
Yes, there is. And as you put it at the beginning, there is a paradox because the efforts that have been done by the country to grow fast have been very strong and they've been under-rewarded. That's the title of the book. Mexico did almost everything right by the standards of what the views of development are. I don't know whether they call it Washington consensus or otherwise. And it was a very disappointing case. In fact, Tim, of all countries of Latin America, with the exception of Venezuela, Mexico is the country that has grown the least.
Which not a lot of people would be thinking. And looking at the figures in the book, per capita GDP growth is at just over 1%. GDP per worker is even less than that. And the productivity improvement over the time has been zero or less than zero, depending on how you measure it. What went wrong?
The standard way of thinking about long-term growth is economies grow because they accumulate physical capital, because they accumulate human capital, the labor force grows and it becomes more educated, or because they become more productive, because productivity goes up. In these three components, Mexico does well in the first two. And the third component, productivity growth, Mexico is a failure. Over two decades, zero productivity growth. So the real puzzle of Mexico's growth is a puzzle of why did productivity not increase? And you would say, look, if you have an economy that is exposed to international trade, facing international competition, benefits from technological flows and financial flows and integration to the world economy, is stabilized and has an increasing supply of human capital, productivity should be going up. It didn't go up, it's zero. And what I try to explain in the book is why. Productivity of an economy is the weighted average of the productivity of all the firms that are in the economy. So to make a really simple example, suppose that the Mexican economy only had one firm. The productivity of Mexico would be the productivity of that firm. If the Mexican economy had two firms, the productivity of Mexico would be the weighted average of the productivity of the two firms, where the weights are how much resources are in one firm and how much resources are in the other firm. Now, when you think about many firms, then what matters is, are there big differences in the productivities of firms? If there are not big differences in the productivity of firms, then the way resources are allocated, it doesn't matter because it doesn't matter whether resources go to firm A or firm B, the productivity is going to be pretty much the same. In the case of Mexico, what I find is that there are huge, huge differences in the productivities of firms. Even, Tim, if you compare firms that are producing pretty much the same goods. And I compare the difference in productivity with, say, what happens in the United States. In the United States, not all firms are equally productive. That would be kind of the Adam Smith paradise in which everything is perfect. And that's not the case. But the difference in productivity in the United States are not that big. By orders of magnitude, they're much bigger in Mexico. something is going on in Mexico that allows very, very productive firms to coexist in the market with very, very unproductive firms. And secondly, that these very, very unproductive firms are capturing a large amount of capital and a large amount of labor to bring down the average from the high productive firms. What I show in the book is that in Mexico, over the two decades in which I study, unproductive firms actually capture more resources than productive firms. And the difference in productivity between the more productive and the least productive firms in Mexico widened. Mexico became a more heterogeneous country with greater disparities inside the economic structure. There is a small subset of Mexican firms that are very, very large, very productive, export a lot, but those don't absorb a large amount of the capital and the labor of Mexico. And there is a very large number of very small, very unproductive firms, each tiny, but there are many of them, and altogether they absorb a large share of labor and a large share of capital, in fact, a growing share of labor and capital. And so that, from a statistical perspective, explains the paradox of a zero aggregate productivity growth, but that average of zero hides a right tail of very productive firms and a very big left tail of very unproductive firms.
How did you get your data for this? Because a lot of data is captured about productive firms. The unproductive firms operate either semi-legally or illegally in some cases, and some are in the informal economy, and it's always a problem to be able to measure this. How did you manage to get that information?
Mexico's data, by Latin American standards, is actually very, very rich. Mexico carries out an economic census every 5 years. And the Statistical Institute will collect data of all firms as long as they have a roof and a wall. People peddling things in the street is not capturing the economic census. That said, any economic activity in a fixed establishment is captured by the census. Very importantly, regardless of whether the establishment is formal or informal, and regardless of whether it has one worker, two workers, or 1,000 workers. So the databases that I use are very large. I have about 4 million firms in the last census, and the data is actually very, very detailed. The capital stock, the number of workers, value added, intermediate inputs, exports, and all that. So I had access to four censuses for 1998, 2003, 2008, and 2013, and I'm able to track firms and follow them over time and have very detailed information in each year. Again, formal, informal, legal or illegal, large or small.
As you say, the fundamental problem here is a misallocation. Is this because creative destruction isn't working? Unproductive firms aren't going out of business?
Correct. If you think about a market economy, we all say, look, Schumpeter taught us all that there's this creative destruction. The bad firms are destroyed. New firms come in. New firms are better than the firms that exit. And that process wins out the bad firms and allows the good firms to survive and grow. And that's how aggregate productivity goes up. What I show in the book is that Schumpeterian creative destruction is offset by Mexican destructive creation. Mexican destructive creation is the process by which bad firms come into the market all the time. Some survive, some die, but are replaced by equally bad firms. And that some high productivity firms actually die. So the market selection process in which productive firms survive and grow and non-productive firms die is broken in Mexico. What I find in the book is that a lot of unproductive firms survive, a lot of productive firms die, and many productive firms that do survive do not grow. There's a very large amount of firm churning, firms coming in, out, and a lot of capital is being wasted, and good firms don't have access to capital to grow. So the underlying microeconomic determinants of the way markets function in Mexico are not working, and that's the reason why productivity has stagnated.
It seems that a lot of this is underpinned by the complex structure of labor contracts in Mexico, which was news to me. Can you explain this to us?
Yes. The Mexican Constitution, which is about 100 years old, makes a very important distinction between workers that are salaried, and all other workers. Let's just call them non-salaried. A salaried worker works for a firm, has a boss, is paid a wage, and a non-salaried worker might be working on his own or in a family firm, Tim, in which the father, the cousin, the son all work in a small little family firm. The Constitution regulates salaried workers and non-salaried workers very differently. For salaried workers, firms must pay for their social insurance, health insurance, retirement pensions, disability insurance, but also firms cannot fire these workers. We have very, very stringent dismissal regulations. Whereas these regulations do not apply for workers that are in a family firm or for self-employed people or people who have a different contract. This changes the relative prices of salaried workers and non-salaried workers in a very large way. A legal firm hiring a salaried worker takes a very large contingent liability when it hires the worker. It has to pay all the social insurance, but in addition, will not be able to fire him. And if it does fire him, the worker can sue the firm in court and the court can tell him, put back the worker in your payroll. And in addition, it must pay income taxes for that worker. Whereas if the firm structures itself without salaried contracts, maybe as a family firm, as I was mentioning before, very small, it's not subject to any of these regulations. Alternatively, the firm might decide to go illegal and completely evade all these regulations. And many firms in Mexico do. The data shows that. But of course, the only way you can be illegal is by being small. It's very easy to run a firm with three or four people being illegal. So what happens in Mexico is that there are very, very few large firms. Less than 1% of all firms in Mexico have more than 50 workers.
Wow.
92% of all firms in Mexico have less than 5 workers. So Mexico is a country that is populated by very, very, very few large firms and a huge number of teeny, weeny, tiny firms. And these tiny firms survive, among other things. We have to talk about taxes and we have to talk about contracts and credit. But among other things, because these firms are not subject to all the labor regulations on social insurance, on dismissal, on reinstatement, and on income taxes. And so it's a very deep reason coming from Mexico's history and Mexico's constitution that is causing this misallocation on the labor side.
So we can't just say we'll solve this problem by bringing people out of the informal sector into the formal sector.
Correct. Now you see the dilemma that Mexico's in, right? Because think now of a country in which a large share of the labor force is informal. In fact, in Mexico, 60% of the labor force is informal. And you say, look, for whatever reason, because there are all these self-employed people or all these non-salaried workers or all these firms cheating, 60% of the labor force doesn't have any kind of social insurance. What the government has done over the last two decades is has created a parallel system of social insurance for all these informal workers with a very, very important characteristic that benefits are free. If a firm hires a salaried worker legally, it has to pay about 30% of the wage for social insurance benefits. But if a firm hires a worker illegally, or if a firm structures itself as a non-salaried firm, the worker will get social insurance benefits for free. And this adds to the regulatory distortions. And you can again see from a social point of view the dilemma in which the government is caught, because you cannot come back and say, oh, look, you shouldn't give free social benefits to all these informal workers because you're subsidizing informality and that's bad for productivity. You know, they're going to say, look, you know, these people need to have their social welfare enhanced. You know, they get sick, they get old. In the last two decades, subsidies for informal workers went from about 0.5 of GDP to almost 2% of GDP today.
What follows from this then is that a small number of successful firms that should be more successful because they should be larger are carrying the burden of a lot of taxation that funds government social spending.
Correct, correct. So from an equity point of view, you say, yes, that's the way it should be. If you think about it from the productivity point of view, you can see the problem. You're taxing the high productivity segment of the economy, and you're turning around and you're subsidizing the low productivity segment of the economy. That's not really what you want to do. What you really wanted to do was to tax high-income individuals and subsidize low-income individuals. But you're taxing high-productivity firms, and therefore they won't grow. And you're subsidizing low productivity firms, and therefore there are a lot of them. And you're not only doing this through the social insurance regime, you're also doing it through the actual tax regime. The corporate income tax regime discriminates in favor of unproductive firms. So in Mexico, if you're a very small firm with sales less than $100,000 a year, your corporate tax rate is 2% of sales. But if you're a firm that sells over $100,000 a year, your corporate tax rate is 30% of profits. You can see the problem.
Yeah.
So firms are not going to grow because after-tax profits are actually going to fall if they grow.
Does this also create a widespread problem of illegality, that contracts are not enforced?
That's yet another dimension that generates the problem in Mexico. Mexico's legal system works very badly in terms of the certainty that commercial contracts between two firms or credit contracts between a firm and a bank are actually going to be complied with. Impounding assets is very complex and very costly and takes a long time because the courts don't work very well and there's a lot of corruption. It's sad to say, but it's true. So in a context in which there's imperfect contract enforcement, firms have a lot of difficulty accessing credit. The banks are not going to take their assets at full value for collateral because they realize that impounding those assets is going to be very costly. So maybe they will value their assets at 30% for collateral for a bank loan. So this will surprise you, Tim. The ratio of credit to GDP of Mexico is the same as the average of sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah. These are institutional problems, though, Santiago. That, as you say, some are more than a century old.
Right.
Surely there are no quick fixes.
Free trade will not fix this. Macroeconomic stabilization will not fix this. Investing in human capital will not fix this. And investment in physical capital will not fix it.
What will fix it?
You have to deal with the fundamental institutional issues. What Mexico has not done over the last two decades is seriously tackle the issues of the institutions in the labor market, of taxation, and of corruption and its judicial institutions. This has been extremely costly to Mexico. The policy implications are, they're very deep. If you want productivity to grow in Mexico, you have to think about this distinction between salaried and non-salaried workers. You have to think about how you provide social insurance. You cannot have these perverse systems. You have to redesign your social insurance. Like in England, you have the National Health Service, in which nobody is charged for health services depending on the labor status in England. But in Mexico, depending on your labor status, you may or may not pay for your health services. This needs to be tackled. Pensions need to be tackled. Taxation needs to be tackled. Corruption needs to be tackled. The usual development story that we have told ourselves did not do it for Mexico, and more of the same will not do it. I'm not saying forget about macroeconomic stabilization and forget about free trade. Of course you need that. I'm all for it. But that recipe is incomplete. The institutions are fundamental.
Finally, Santiago, is this a particularly Mexican story, or are there warnings here for other emerging economies?
I know less about African and other regions of the world, but with nuances and differences, there are many similarities in other Latin American economies with Mexico. And if you think about the broad picture, Tim, Latin America as a whole has grown less than the rest of the world. And the reason that Latin America as a whole has grown less is because productivity in Latin America has also grown less. So I don't have the data for these other countries, but I know them, and I would not be surprised if a story like the one from Mexico would actually be turn out to be validated by the data in those countries. But if I think about Colombia, Peru, Central America, Bolivia, Paraguay, perhaps not Chile, perhaps not Argentina, but many of these countries would have a story that looks like this. And there might be a lesson for some African countries looking forward. Think deeply about your institutions for social insurance and for taxation. It's not only a matter of providing benefits and collecting revenues by any combination of programs. The incentives implicit in taxation and the incentives implicit in your social insurance and labor market regulations are fundamental, and you have to tailor them to your context. Mexico didn't do it, and we paid a high price.
Santiago, thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
A reminder that the book's called Underrewarded Efforts, The Elusive Quest for Prosperity in Mexico. There are some really valuable and interesting lessons in there. It's available from the Inter-American Development Bank. It's a free download, so search for it on their website. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. You can find more in the series at voxdev.org.